Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Can I tell you, it's so great to have people alongside us. Andrew Sheets, one of them, just dropped by from Morgan Stanley, the chief cross-asset strategist. Andrew, it's good to see you, Mr. Sheets. When can I buy this equity market?
Well, thanks. It's nice to be with you. It's nice to be with you in person. Look, this is an equity market that I think over the next month is still dealing with a real crucible of challenges. We are into the thick of what we think is going to be a disappointing earnings revision lower. That's a key view of my colleague Michael Wilson in the U.S., my colleague Graham Secker here in Europe. I think this is still a period where it's going to be very difficult for the Fed to sound anything other than hawkish, given these upside surprises to inflation. And then on the geopolitical front, right, it's too soon to get anything real developments in terms of changes in China policy, and still a lot of uncertainty into European energy policy heading into winter. So we think it's still too soon, especially with rates rising, especially in the front end, and think investors should stay cautious. And we think that cash will outperform a lot of assets.
There is, at Brown University, a fabulous tradition of differential geometry. Cornell and Brown on the high ground on that. And it all comes down to calculus. Are you frightened by the rates of change right now and the second derivative as well?
Well, I think the biggest change that I think the market is going to have to adjust to is, you know, investors over the last 12 years, which is a quite long period of time, have known mostly rates of zero or less than zero on cash.
Well, Nassim Taleb said this out on Twitter yesterday. He said it's like physics without gravity. Are we getting used to gravity again?
I think we're getting used to gravity. I think we're seeing a real large adjustment. So if you think about the S&P 500 having an earnings yield of about 5.9% and, you know, 1 to 5 year corporate bonds having a yield of 4.9%, that is an enormous convergence in cross-asset yields. And so, and that's a shift we haven't seen for 12 years. So I think that's an adjustment that is truly different and that the market's going to have to, you know, make some adjustments for.
There's a difference between more downside in risk assets and something breaking and something that becomes a systemic issue that is a fissure and that is rapid. When does something break as we take a look at that pace of change, particularly with the front end rate?
Yeah, so Lisa, I think that's such a great point, because I think ironically here, the fact that stuff is good, i.e. not breaking, means that the Fed can and likely will do more. You know, I think we see banks with very healthy balance sheets. We see consumers and corporates with healthy balance sheets. The low rates of the last 2 years allowed a lot of Americans to refinance into low 30-year fixed rate mortgages, which means their largest liability, their highest cost, is almost immune from the rate hikes. And so that strength, I think, means that the market is sending the Fed signals you can keep going. We haven't yet hit that point where it's disorderly.
So what is that point? I mean, can they get up to the Deutsche Bank call of 4.9% on a Fed funds rate and still have things be sanguine enough to give them some confidence that they can stay there for a while?
Well, so we don't think rates will get that high, but we do think that the skew is that they will continue to press higher and go for longer. And again, I think the Fed is having a real challenge, right? In hockey terms, they are trying to skate to the puck. And we don't know exactly what the delay between, you know, a rate hike today and an impact on the economy is going to be. And so this is a real uncertainty. I think the market was hopeful that we would get some relief, that inflation would start heading in the right direction, and that would buy the Fed some time. But I think it's quite clear with that sticky core inflation, they just cannot pivot yet, and then the skew is towards tighter policy.
Is that the anti-Gretzky? Is that what that was? Do you like that? You're proud of me. You're so proud.
I'm going to tear up here.
I know.
Get the spelling right on that banner. I mean, I saw Gretzky actually do this. This is absolute
fun. I knew that would get you going.
He was playing the Buffalo Sabres in Perot, and Gretzky did exactly what you said. Jerome Powell is no Wayne Gretzky, is he?
Well, I do think what you're dealing with is, if you ask a lot of economists, right, there's not an agreement on what that delay between a rate hike today is on the economy. And then I think there's still very divergent camps, theoretically, right? I think there's a camp, and we heard this last year, the Fed can never hike very much because there's so much debt in the economy, they'll never hike more than 1% or 2%, versus, well, actually, maybe companies and households have termed out so much debt at super low rates that the sensitivity is lower. And I think this is a real question that you kind of don't really know until it makes contact with the economy.
So, Andrew, we came out of the last crisis in 08-09, and you all remember the projections for high yields every single year. High yields, never materialized, yields went lower. Do you sense it's that kind of story in reverse, that we haven't quite fully capitulated on this view of a low interest rate world, that we just seem to think that this is an anomaly and we're going back to where we were before?
I think there's still some of that, you know, and I think the real rate is a very interesting debate, where real rates are still quite low. In the U.S., in the Eurozone, in the U.K., they have not yet gone back to kind of just the pre-GFC level, let alone kind of the higher levels we saw in the 90s. So I think there's still room for the market to readjust, especially as you see a healthy household, healthy corporate balance sheets, more capital expenditure that, again, could point to kind of somewhat higher, neutral levels of interest.
I put out that Deutsche Bank call from Matt Lazzetti, 5% Fed funds next year. The amount of pushback I got on that call, just because people wonder whether we can actually live, Lisa, and you've spoken to this a few times, in a 5% interest rate world anymore.
Yeah, and I think that Andrew Scheese's point, saying that basically people have termed it out, and the fact that they are coping with it, gives this uncertainty of maybe we have gotten less rate sensitive and allows the Fed to go further, is really underpinning the reality of what people are pricing in.
You know how you try and get me to explain football to people who don't know football? Can you explain Gretzky
to
everyone?
Why are you looking at me?
Can you explain Gretzky to everyone?
No, this is, I'm going to tear up
to where you
folks,
think the puck is going to be.
Everybody knows. Everybody knows. I know less about English football than
what
Guy Johnson.
What do I know about ice hockey?
But you dazzle me. How do you know that Gretzky skated to where the puck wasn't?
Because his daughter married a very, very good golfer. So I sort of reverse engineered it from golf through his wife and back into ice hockey. That's how I did it. Does that work for you?
I have a lot of
questions. Does that work for you? So sort of reversed engineered it from golf to ice hockey.
And then
learn about that famous quote. Tom, you know, it takes a lot of work. Andrew Sheets and Morgan Stanley. Andrew, thank you. It's good to see you. Will we get on for the next 2 hours? We will get on along with Jane Foley, I can guarantee you that. Head of FX strategy at Rabobank. Jane, the significance of a 113 on sterling. Can we start there?
Well, it's very significant, as Lisa talked about, 1992 and sterling being forced out of the ERM. And, you know, when thinking about that story this morning, the first thing that came to my mind was the current account position of the UK. Because if you've got a current account deficit, and don't forget, the UK deficit as a percentage of GDP is right now at record levels. It's much worse than it was in 1992. But if you have a deficit, really you're exposing your country to more of the whims of non-domestic investors. And if they do not like the fundamentals that they see, your currency is going to adjust lower. Now, right now, I think that's something which has been happening to the pound, you know, for a while. The market doesn't like the growth story. It doesn't like the Brexit story.
Right.
And it doesn't like the fact that the tax cuts that are coming from the new prime minister could really push the public finances into numbers that people just don't like. So sterling is vulnerable, and that current account position really exposes the UK. Now, of course, a lot of the story is dollar strength, but there is certainly sterling weakness in here. And one thing that we did see earlier in the year is interest rate hikes couldn't they couldn't pull the pound out of the hole.
To Lisa's point.
To Lisa's point. Will a 75 basis points move offer that much protection? Well, some maybe, but not all.
Chris Giles, the FT, with a brilliant short essay pulling the United Kingdom back to, I believe, 1972-74, and Mr. Barber, the complete failed plan then, is this Chancellor of the Exchequer going down in flames with a growth model that's undoable?
Well, certainly the market is extremely skeptical. I mean, he's been talking about a growth target for the UK at 2.5%. Nobody really expects that can happen. So you're talking about tax cuts, which will give a bit of a boost, but actually what investors want to see are measures that are going to improve, you know, productivity and growth and potential output, not just a quick fix from tax cuts. So investors are skeptical, and that is what the government is facing, and that is what the government today appears to be ignoring.
It's a sterling story. It's a Chinese yuan story. There are specific stories about weakness, but on the other side, it's very much a dollar story, especially as we're pricing in such high potential Fed funds rates next year. What is your sense of when things break, of when the stronger dollar creates weakness that becomes hard for all of these other central banks and these economies to get out from under?
I think you could probably already argue that the strength of the dollar is already pushing half of the economy, half the world economy under the bus. You know, it is very, very difficult. And I think we see this already for a long time in emerging markets. So many interest rate hikes there to try and protect their currencies. Look at just Korea
at
this
Plaza
week.
Level?
Well, you see, I don't think that's particularly logical, because if you have a central bank putting up interest rates, you know, you've got to say, well, a strong dollar is a byproduct of that policy. So why then come in on the other hand and say, well, we're going to weaken this currency? It's not logical. So maybe we were talking about some sort of Plaza thing, maybe next year when the Fed is confident that it has got inflation under control.
But is there a negative feedback loop that you can think of from the rest of the world into the US economy that the Fed has to respond to?
I mean, I don't know whether the Fed has to respond to it, because after all, the Fed's, you know, primary objective is domestic inflation and domestic employment. Should it address it? You know, I don't know. You know, that's another question. But certainly there is a feedback loop into the US dollar, because as the rest of the world weakens, as emerging markets weaken, people tend to buy the dollar.
Yeah.
And so if you're buying the dollar because the strong dollar is worsening the environment for the rest of the world, you've got this
feedback. It gets more buy-in.
Absolutely. So, you know, what is going to break it? I think it's only going to break maybe, you know, next year when the Fed thinks, you know what, we can calm down on this. We've got a handle on medium-term inflation expectations.
Until then, let's talk about some levels and squeeze this in. Cable, sterling against the US dollar, 113. Euro dollar in and around parity. Dollar China, 3.7. Are you thinking of some big moves from here, or is this kind of it?
I don't think it's it yet. We're thinking 95 on euro dollar. I mean, we've got a horrible winter to come for Europe. Yeah, you know, energy price crisis. You know, rationing. Is that all priced in up? I think perhaps not. Have we got an Italian election? You know, will the far right get in? You know, that's perhaps, you know, the next potential trigger for the euro in just a few weeks' time. On cable, our target now is 109. People are out there talking about parity. Can we dismiss that? You know, no, I don't think we can dismiss it. It's not our target, but, you know, it depends very much on the US dollar. So, you know, these are still nasty numbers to come. And right now, you know, I think the dollar strength will sustain until you can honestly answer the question, well, what else are you going to buy?
For the best part of 10 years, I think it's fair to say foreign exchange was kind of boring, and it's not boring anymore.
No.
Not at all.
No.
Jane, great to catch up. Jane Foley there of Rabobank.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor Data Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right now, with your most important brief of the day on fixed income, Subrata Rajapa joins us, head of United States rate strategy at the French bank Société Générale. Their history of math derivative dynamics is world class. Subrata, thank you for joining us. When you look at the derivative mathematics of what we've seen in the last 2 days or even last 2 weeks, what is a telling story about the rates of change in fixed income?
It's stunning. I mean, we were looking at, if you look at a chart, and I think John was showing the chart earlier of the 2 year, we've gone somewhere between 20 basis points last year this time to close to 4% right now. So the rate of change has been just absolutely stunning. You know, to me, what I'm looking at is the message that you're getting from the bond market, which is, you know, to take a page from, I think Facebook's, motto, it's like move fast and break things. That's kind of what the Fed is is about to do, which is if they do go along the path that the market has laid out, they're going to have to break things ultimately. And that's what the curve is really suggesting to us.
I got 8 ways to go here. I'm going to go pro on you right now, Subrata, and that's of all the different spreads, there's that one across all of the yield curve, the 2 year, you'll go to 3 months, but let's take the 2 year to the former benchmark 30-year bond. It is at a place we literally haven't seen almost in a lifetime, 2000. What is the importance of the level of inversion of the 2s-30 spread?
Absolutely. The 5s-30s, the 2s-30 spread is really at levels we haven't seen in 2 decades. So to me, what the message there is that the market ultimately, if you look at 10 years and beyond, is looking at the potential for a meaningful slowdown in growth and, you know, perhaps a hard landing, especially if the Fed hikes rates as aggressively as what's priced in the market. You're looking at a terminal Fed funds rate right now around 4.5%. I mean, that level was at 4% or below just before the CPI print this week. So the move and the repricing higher of the terminal Fed funds rate has been quite dramatic in a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
So that would mean that there's a potential, much higher potential for a hard landing.
Lisa, I'm going to tear up here. What a control room we have. Qantas and the crew, they throw up a 230 spread chart. No one else in financial media does that.
Can you stop referring to our Australian producer as an airline?
I mean, to see the 230 inverted live on television. For those of you on radio, it's just an act of God. It's just wonderful.
What am I, BA?
Definitely. No, he rejected BA a little bit ago. No, Subrata, let's get back to the bond market. I think that's a safer place for us to sit on. Maybe, although maybe not. The question is, where do we stop, right? And where do we stop not only with twos, but also with tens, given that people are wondering, are we going to break something? And what does the post-breakage look like? Are we still looking at a higher inflation rate, at a higher real interest rate in an era where we're not talking about zero yields anymore?
Yeah, no, I think that really at this next meeting, given how dramatically yields have risen, I'd be looking to hear from Chair Powell on what they think their policy path is going to be. And in my view, at least, I feel like the market has gotten a little bit ahead of itself, and Powell might have to thread the needle and try to sort of talk the market away from the ledge, if you will. Because, yes, they do want to front-load rate hikes. Yes, they do want to get to 4% in a rush, but I think that they're going to take a much more measured approach beyond 4%. to make sure that they're not breaking things as they're raising rates. So it's going to be a balancing act between what's happening on the employment front. You know, you spoke about FedEx earlier. They'll be looking at a variety of metrics to see what the impact of higher interest rates are on the broader economy. They know that monetary policy acts with lags. So they're going to have to figure out what that lag is and how to act now so that the monetary policy transmission is effective and doesn't break things over the longer run.
Subhadra, does that mean that you're in there buying two-year bonds?
Buying two-year bonds? You know, not necessarily. I mean, I think the Fed is not going to be, you know, buying bonds anytime soon.
Subhadra. I'm just wondering whether it's a good opportunity, whether we basically have seen a peak. If you're going to expect the Fed to push back and give the market a little bit of assurance that perhaps they've gotten ahead of themselves, does this mean there's an opportunity in short-term debt?
There might be. The question is whether you want to enter into that trade now, perhaps leg in if you start getting, you know, closer to 4% and twos. I mean, yields start looking very, very attractive. I think you're going to see perhaps a little bit of a tactical steepening between, say, the 3-year and the 10-year part of the curve. I'm still afraid to touch the 2-year part of the curve because it's pegged to Fed expectations and has the potential to move higher.
Right.
But I would say tactically positioned for, say, a 3-year, 10-year steepening makes sense to me, at least over the short term.
All right. So, Brad, it's away from your remit, but I'm going there. It's a Friday. No one's listening or watching. What do you do with a 60-40 allocation in bonds? I mean, come on. In this world, with these rates of change, I look at the Bloomberg Total Return Index, and 60-40 is getting absolutely crushed.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, all assets are very correlated right now. You're seeing, you know, bonds sell off, equity sell off, the dollar continue to tighten. At some point, when you've seen a significant move in risky assets, the best place you want to be is going to be in bonds because yields are looking very, very attractive across the curve. You know, even in the long end, even though yields haven't risen as much as they've done in the very front end, you know, you still see pretty consistent demand from asset liability managers and pension funds for the very long end. So I think that that sort of trade is here to stay, and that's going to keep long end yields, you know, somewhat, you know, pegged. And, you know, it makes sense because if you're looking at a much longer term horizon, you probably want to be long bonds, especially at a time when equities are performing very poorly.
Subhadra, we've got to leave it there. Thank you. Subhadra Jappa there of SocGen on the latest
great
in this bond market.
Jose Antonio Ocampo joins us now, Minister of Finance and Public Credit for his Colombia. We're thrilled that he could join us this morning. There's so much to talk about, Minister, but I have to go larger. I have to reach back to Stan Fisher in 1998. Do you, through the prism of Colombia economics and foreign exchange, see anything like an international upset that we witnessed in 1998 and frankly before that in 1992?
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be with you. Let me say on that that I don't think the same kind of crisis, the 1998, was very much an emerging market crisis. This is a global crisis. Both the slowdown, particularly the inflation, and the increase in interest rate, which is affecting us very heavily.
And very importantly, sir, I look at the caps, the limitation of price increase. We see it on India and their challenges with rice. Here in the United Kingdom, we see it. And indeed, Colombia and others talk about it. Given a more global economy, the speed of information, the transfer of finance, can caps be effective in 2023?
Well, let me say that the major problem that we're getting from the global economy is the inflation, but particularly the effect it has had on interest rates. So both domestic interest rates in Colombia, as well as the interest rate in global capital markets are very high, and that the major specific effect. Of course, inflation is hard to fight due to the international dimensions of inflation. So for a specific country, it is very tough to fight that inflation, which you can say is a supply inflation rather than a demand inflation. Central banks are good at managing demand inflation, but less so in managing supply inflation.
There's a great concern that when the Fed hikes rates by as much as the market is currently pricing in, Minister, that it will create some real problems for the rest of the world. And I wonder from your Colombia whether you're taking a look at the dollar market and saying we cannot raise money in that right now at affordable rates. Is that really the situation as you look at your financing needs looking out?
Yes, private capital markets are very expensive for emerging economies today. Including, of course, Colombia. So for the time being, our international financing is coming from multilateral development banks and official institutions. But so far, we have not gone this year into the private capital markets. We hope things normalize somewhat in the near future, and we'll go back to the market. We're expecting to raise about $1.5 billion in the private capital markets next year.
What does it mean for things to stabilize, Minister? Does it mean that the dollar stabilizes? Does it mean that the Fed stops raising rates? Does it mean that inflation stops accelerating?
Well, it really means that the long-term interest rates of the U.S. start to fall. They were falling actually before the recent announcement of the Fed that they would likely increase interest rates again in the next meeting. But before that, they were falling, and also the risk margins for emerging markets were also falling. But the situation has changed again. But we hope at one point when the inflation stabilizes in the United States, the interest rates of the U.S., particularly long-term interest rates, which are the relevant for us, start to fall.
Dr. Ocampo, you have been one of the great voices of Colombia through a time, and the stereotype in America is of true civil unrest in Colombia. You've moved beyond that with a new government and your participation as well. Can you describe the stability in Colombia and what it means for your tourism? So many people have gone to Cartagena and the rest of it. Describe the tourism future for Colombia after decades of real unrest.
Well, let me say that the peace process that took place 5 years ago has been fairly successful in generating peace in several parts of the country. The current government is involved in other negotiations that we hope will be successful, and let's say the return to peace in many parts of the country has generated effectively what you say, actually a boom of tourism. We hope that it will come back when the world economy fully recovers, because tourism in the world is still a bit depressed, let's say, although it's recovering. And in Colombia, we'll hope to have a new boom of tourism.
Minister, we appreciate your time today. It's lucky to catch up with you. We're lucky to catch up with you. Jose Antonio Ocampo there.
General equilibrium theory. And in the middle of all that is stochastic. And what that means is things are moving rapidly. And Seth Carpenter is chief global economist at Morgan Stanley and knows decidedly it is a stochastic 2022. Seth, what is the process or path to get to calmer times, a calmer economy, and calmer markets?
I think that prospect will require a fair amount of luck. I think the challenge here, especially you started off talking about the Fed, they are feeling their way to how far they have to raise the federal funds rate. They want to be restrictive. They want aggregate demand to slow down a lot so that that underlying inflationary pressure starts to ebb. But what they don't want to do is intentionally cause a recession. And getting to that point, I think, will require a bit of luck.
How do you respond to the idea that the inflation impulse has a certain effect on the public, but the jobless impulse has a much greater effect?
Oh, I think they're both very, very important. Clearly, for people who have lost their jobs, that's just very, very difficult. It crimps their spending a great deal. We don't have in our forecast any meaningful rise in layoffs. In fact, if you look at the last jobs report, that was super strong at over 300,000. So far, that's been okay. The inflationary side of things, though, very much hits the pocketbooks of everyday people. The rise in gas prices that we saw a few months ago was painful. That's starting to come off now. I think the challenge for the Fed then will be, if gas prices come down, do people go back to spending more, or have they been hit hard enough in the pocketbook?
Seth, we spent the whole of summer trying to work out what the threshold would be for a pivot, a pause, maybe even rate cuts next year. You've got rate cuts out in 2024. I just wonder, what is it about 2024 where you think this threshold is going to be breached and the Fed starts cutting?
So I will just own up front, the uncertainty here is huge.
Of course.
We said for many, many years, lower for longer was what central banks are doing. Now it is higher for longer. And again, I think what the Fed is trying to do is feel their way to where they can rein in the economy without actually causing an outright recession. And that's the reason why they go to what they call restrictive territory, but then not so much that things actually crash, and then hang out there as the economy slows down. So that's what we have as our baseline, is you're getting some traction, and then they just wait for things to slow down.
Right. John, I just want to point out, equity futures just moved to new lows for the morning.
Another leg lower.
Yeah, another leg lower.
And that's the story so far, Seth, and the story many people are grappling with for participants in markets at the moment is whether these are sufficiently tight financial conditions for this Fed to achieve its objective. Do you think they are right now sufficiently tight?
Very hard to say. I will say one of the most typically sensitive sectors is housing, and we have seen a very strong rollover there in housing. On the other hand, consumer durable goods spending is actually still holding up to some degree, so it's not clear that things have actually bitten yet. That said, you were talking about equities. My colleague Mike Wilson always points out that this probably needs to be a leg lower in earnings projections, and I think that makes sense. If the economy is going to slow down enough to get inflationary pressures under control, you just have to expect earnings across the board to be lower than they are now, and we're just not there yet.
I like your call for holding it at 4%, though, for almost a year for the Fed funds rate. And I wonder if people are underestimating the pain of holding rates at a level like that, rather than just missing the boat, raising too far, and then quickly cutting again, which seems to be the projection in markets.
I think there probably is a bit of underestimation there, but I suspect the even greater underestimation is what happens if hiking rates to 4% isn't enough? What happens if they hike to 4%, wait there for a quarter or two, and the economy just proves to be strong enough that demand is there and inflation doesn't come down? Then the Fed's just going to keep hiking. And I think that point, that there's not really an upside to economic growth right now. It is either things slow down and inflation comes under control, or they don't slow down and the Fed just hikes more until they do slow down.
John and Tom both make fun of me because at 4:30 p.m. on Thursdays, I take a look at the Fed's balance sheet to see where it is and whether it's coming down as they promise quantitative tightening. Over the past week, it actually rose. It became bigger, even though they ostensibly were supposed to be accelerating quantitative tightening. When do we start to feel the effects of this? When does it start to matter for markets?
That's a great question. And you and I can sort of bond on Thursday afternoons. That was a big part of my job at the Fed, was being in charge of the H4O1 statistical release. Nerd alert. The challenge, I think, with getting QT to actually show up on the balance sheet in large part is, some of the way they're settling their mortgage-backed securities holdings on a forward basis. And so it really hasn't shown up. Just give it a couple more months. The treasuries are coming off their balance sheet. Over time, the mortgage-backed securities will prepay and go away, but it does take a long time.
Seth, I look at ADXY as a bundled Pacific Rim thermometer, if you would. I look at Korean won unraveling through the week. Help us into the weekend and into the Asia morning. What is the gamesmanship Morgan Stanley sees? And you've got Robbie Feldman in Tokyo, who's iconic, but what is the gamesmanship you see of the Bank of Japan and the Ministry of Finance into their Monday morning, our Sunday evening? Are we close to action?
That is a great question. So our baseline view is no, not from the Bank of Japan. You have Governor Kuroda in place. His term is up in the first half of next year. He has been committed for so long to being easy with policy to try to get inflation up. Now it is working. Clearly, the yen has gone on a tear, going lower and lower and lower against the dollar. But finally, they're starting to get some traction with inflation.
Seth, very importantly, what do you read and listen to from Robbie Feldman? You have the advantage of Dr. Feldman in Tokyo, who's absolutely iconic on this. What is Robbie's twist on this?
No, Robbie is fantastic, and I think everybody should get the opportunity to read his work. I think the key really is here all about legacy, the amount of time and effort that has been put into this very easy policy to try to get inflation up. Japan has had lost decades, plural now, when it comes to the deflationary spiral. And I think there really is a sense, at least with Governor Kuroda, that it's critical to stay the course to get inflation up.
Seth, can we just wrap things up with FedEx? It's such a big story for everyone this morning. It's arguably contributing to some of the nervousness around the equity market as well. The stock's down almost 21% in the pre-market. We all know this is not a small company. It was something like a $50, $60 billion company. It won't be if we close here a little bit later. Seth, they're talking about speed, that things have slowed down really, really quickly. Is there anything that you look at on your dashboard that would perhaps resonate with what FedEx are experiencing? Can you see anything like this?
Well, I think one of the key points with companies like FedEx in the shipping business is we did see this massive, massive surge in goods spending. Yesterday's retail sales report didn't really make you feel like it has unwound completely yet, but it does seem that at some point we're going to have to see that consumer pullback from as much consumer spending as had been going on physical goods. And that's going to have ripple effects across the economy to retailers, but also to companies that do a lot of shipping.
Seth Carpenter of Morgan Stanley. Seth, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Seth.
It's good to hear from you.
Thank you.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.